You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
Packaging and advertising for fair trade products often tell the consumer that by purchasing such products, she's making a difference. Such industry discourses tell us fair trade works and that we're helping to end poverty one cup of fair trade coffee at a time. Yet to what extent has the fair trade movement succeeded in challenging the capitalist relationship entrenched between consumers in richer countries and producers in poorer countries? Ian Hussey explored this question in his recent article, Fair Trade and Empire, an Anti-Capitalist Critique of the Fair Trade Movement. It appeared in Briar Patch magazine. Ian is a PhD candidate at York University. He was the co-founding national coordinator of the Canadian Student Fair Trade Network, and we've reached him this morning in Toronto. Hello, Ian.
Hi, Lorraine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. In a nutshell, what systemic problems rooted in the relationship between producer and consumer do you think the fair trade movement has succeeded in addressing?
Well, I think fair trade has succeeded in making visible some of the unjust conditions that workers in various parts of the world face in their daily lives. So I think that's a big positive about fair trade.
Now, your article describes an institutionalized contradiction in fair trade exchange where consumers hold more decision-making power in the exchange than producers do. What does that look like?
Yeah, I definitely believe that. I think one of the major issues that fair trade doesn't deal with well is the imbalance of power between consumers and business people in the global north and peasants that are producing these products in the global south. So I think a lot of times, like you mentioned in your intro, fair trade packaging claims that fair trade makes this big difference and transforms these people's lives. And really in my work, in my activism, in my research, I found that the impact of fair trade isn't as much as, we've been led to believe. And, it's not to say that it doesn't have any impact, but it's certainly not this great transformative thing that a lot of people, with good intentions, think that it is.
Well, draw that out a little bit for me. What does that look like in the system? For instance, for a small producer co-op, how are they disempowered from the overall economic interchange?
Okay. Well, the good thing about fair trade is it sets a floor price, so a minimum price for all the different commodities that are sold as fair trade certified: coffee, chocolate, tea. So producers know, signing long-term contracts and having a minimum price for the products, that they're going to receive a certain amount of income for the yield of their harvest. So that's a good thing, to know how much income you're going to have so you can kind of plan for your community and your family. Unfortunately, though, for like 15 years, that floor price for coffee and for a lot of other commodities didn't change at all. And there was no conversation of changing that price. And in that time, actually, there's been recent research done that the floor price has been devalued by like 40% because of inflation. So we have this instance where people know, in a general sense, how much income they're going to have, yet the value of that income has actually been reduced because of inflation. The other thing about fair trade related to this is it's great that producers are organized into cooperatives so they can make collective decisions about their lives. Unfortunately, fair trade is still a capitalist mode of trade. So these people may collectively own the land that they work, and they may produce products together. But when they sell those, they're actually not getting much of the value that they're producing themselves in producing those commodities. So much of the value of those commodities is still going to businesses in Canada, the U.S., or some European country, or some intermediary between the producers and, the retail shop in Vancouver or Toronto or what have you. So when we talk about, how empowering this is to producers, that's really the limitation. They're not getting as much for their product as they really deserve. And related to that also, they don't have as much say as into how fair trade is organized. So the standards that are going to regulate their work, it's going to regulate how much they get paid, it's going to regulate their relationship to us as consumers, their relationship to businesses that are buying those products, a lot of those decisions are actually made by fair trade certifiers, like Fair Trade Canada, Fair Trade USA, and other certifying bodies around the world that certify these products. And producers don't really have a lot of say in that process, unfortunately.
Ian, you talk about, you actually wrote that while fair trade campaigns may defetishize or devalue certain products by making visible some of the unjust conditions of productions, many of these same campaigns refetishize products and their producers by imbuing them with a reified exotic character. Can you pull that apart a little bit and sort of tell us what that might look like on the ground to a consumer and to a producer?
Yeah, definitely. So when I started consuming fair trade products in the mid-90s, I thought, oh, this is great. You know, I really want to make a difference in the world. This seems like if I buy these products, you know, it's really going to empower someone in Mexico or Peru or whatever. And at that point, I was still a teenager, and I personally was thinking about folks in Latin America and in Africa in pretty racist ways, actually, you know, and I've come to learn that. So when I talk about dealing with commodity fetishism, what I mean is, you know, fair trade makes visible certain relations of production. So we get that, okay, these people own little plots of land, and they organize themselves into cooperatives, and so they have some sort of level of power over, you know, how they organize production. But at the other end of the trade, when we buy our products in places like Canada, the products are then put into a package, and on the package, you know, you might have a little child smiling, or you might see hands cupped together with coffee cherries in it, and the hands are really worn, you know, and they're generally not white hands, right? And there's this fetishization of not only the skin color of these people, but really, you know, the fact that fair trade, oh, it's so happy, you know, look, the children are smiling, you're making a difference in their lives, when, you know, as I've been saying, these workers actually aren't getting enough value for the products they're producing, and they don't really have as much power in the certification system as I believe they should.
Now, Ian, since your article was released, a major development occurred in the fair trade movement, and that's that the Fair Trade USA announced it's going to leave Fair Trade International, and a large part of the decision rested on the fact that the U.S. organization wanted to pursue certifying fair trade products made on large plantations instead of solely on cooperatives and small producers. How will that affect the relationships that you've been talking about and the power balance between consumer and producer?
It's going to affect it in a very real and major way. So we don't know at this point when Fair Trade USA officially leaves the international certification system at the beginning of 2012 exactly how those plantations are going to be organized. And what I mean by that is we're not sure if the producers living on that land are going to own a little bit of the plantation themselves, like actually own the land, if they're going to be allowed to organize themselves into a union or a cooperative, how much say they're going to have in their working conditions and their living conditions, and what their relationship is going to be to the large landowner that owns that plantation. And this has been a classic issue in the movement against sweatshops. And what I mean by that is, in the anti-sweatshop movement, it's always been an issue to actually get to these workers, see where they're working, get into their factory, and look at their working conditions. And when this happens in the fair trade system for commodities like coffee, chocolate, and commodities like that, or that are sold in the U.S., you know, I have to think that the fair trade certified producers are going to want to research this themselves. Academics like myself and some of my colleagues in the U.S. are going to want to research this. But the question, again, remains, are we going to have access to that land and those workers to see, like, hey, you know, how are these people being treated? You know, what are the power relationships here? How much say do they have in this thing? But a larger issue, and this deals really with capitalism in a systemic way, is this means that these workers are more than likely not going to own the land that they're working, they're farming, which means they don't own their means of production, which is different in a very important way from workers that are organized into small-scale production. They actually own the farms that they're working. They live on those, you know, and that makes a big difference as to not only being able to get more value for the coffee or the chocolate they're producing, but they can also produce food that they and their families can consume. You know, I have to believe this is not going to happen for these workers that are going to be working on these plantations that Fairtrade USA is going to certify. And moreover, more than likely, the coffee and chocolate that's coming from those plantations that's going to be sold in the U.S. is going to be sold by major transnational corporations. We're talking like Walmart, Starbucks, and, you know, all the corporations that many people, probably like you and I, protest against regularly. So then, you know, we could have Joe and Jay consumer going into a Walmart and buying fair trade coffee, which already happens in the U.S. It's just going to happen differently now because that coffee is more than likely going to come from a plantation. So unbeknownst maybe to that consumer, they're going to go in there and they're going to say, hey, fair trade, all right, this is a good thing. You know, beyond the fact that we might look at them and say, oh, well, you know, you're shopping in a Walmart, first of all, right? And we all know, hopefully, that Walmart is really terrible in its relationship to a lot of sweatshops in all parts of the world. But in this sense, you know, this gives Walmart a chance to say, hey, you know, look at us. We're actually a good corporation. We're doing good in the world. We're helping these farmers in, you know, Mexico or wherever. And, you know, that's a real challenge for the fair trade movement. So now, in places like Canada, you know, we're going to, as fair trade advocates, we're actually going to have to, beyond explaining all kinds of complicated things about politics and economics that we already have to explain, we're going to have to talk about these issues to do with plantations, to do with the fact that the workers don't own the land and that sort of thing. And, you know, that's just a whole heap of more work for people who are already overworked as activists, right? So that's a really serious concern for me.
Ian, just briefly, because we're closing in on the time that we have, but I'm wondering if you could say, for somebody who, you know, who is committed to the ideals or the, you know, the base ideals of free trade, of a fair exchange between people, hearing your critique, which I think is very valuable, what can people do to move forward the idea of fair trade while not sort of succumbing to this kind of, you know, I guess it would be greenwashing or fair trade washing aspect of the fair trade exchange?
Yeah. So in fair trade, in the fair trade world, it's called fair washing. And so that's already been an issue when transnationals started to buy into fair trade markets, starting with coffee. But the thing that I've realized in being a fair trade activist for about a decade now is generally people who are involved in fair trade as activists, as consumers, as business people, you know, they really genuinely want to make the world a better place, right? And so but what I've also realized is a lot of those folks, after they've been involved in the movement for a little bit, realize, like, okay, you know, we're not making as much of a change as that we would really like to see in the world. And so, like myself and some other people, we try to advocate within the movement, which the public doesn't see, to lobby the certifiers or lobby businesses to be more fair. So in the case of certifiers, a few years ago, producers weren't on the board of the international certification system. And producers organized themselves across Latin America and the Caribbean, across Africa, across Asia, like millions of workers. And they rose up together and they said, hey, you know, we want to be on this board of directors. This directly affects our lives way more than you folks in Europe or North America. And so when that happened, they asked people like myself in Canada and other folks in the U.S. and in Europe to publicize this a bit to our fair trade networks.
Well, I think, Ian, I'm sorry, but I think we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time this morning. But it's been great talking to you and very informative.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Ian Hussey. Ian's article, Fair Trade and Empire, An Anti-Capitalist Critique of Fair Trade, appeared in the most recent issue of Briar Patch magazine.